Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 28th of January. This hour, we're going to be talking about a number of issues related to immigration. Despite the tremendous risks and obstacles, our guest this hour writes, thousands of migrants venture out from their countries of birth every day in attempts to improve their lives. Others flee their home countries due to death threats or in the aftermath of personal violence. Many of these clandestine migrants are able to cross borders and change their lives. But many are deported. There have been 5 million deported from the U.S. since 1997, 2.5 times the total of all deportations prior to 1997. Mass deportation has been mostly among Latin American and Caribbean men. We will talk about that. We'll look at the Supreme Court hearing a challenge to the Obama immigration action. And we'll talk about a Pew Research Center survey released just in November that shows more Mexicans are leaving than coming to the United States. Our guest this hour has been studying these issues for quite some time. Professor Tanya Golash-Boza is with us, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Merced. She is the author most recently of Deported, Immigrant Policing, Disposable Labor, and Global Capitalism, also author of Immigration Nation and Due Process Denied. We'll be welcoming phone calls for her, as we always do for our guests. Our phone number, and I would imagine that the lines will be pretty busy on this issue of immigration, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Let's talk first about the number of deportations, 5 million since 1997. Why so many deportations since that time?
Right. That's a great question. So just to give a little bit of perspective, there had never been more than 40,000 deportations.
Oh, my goodness.
A year prior to 1996. So there's two things that happened that explain the uptick since 1996. So the first reason is that in 1996, President Bill Clinton signed into law two pieces of legislation, the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, and then the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. And what those two laws did is they expanded the grounds on which you could be deported, and they narrowed the ground for appeal. So it made it more difficult for people who may have had a case against deportation prior to 1996 to present those reasons in the immigration court. So that's the first reason. So in 1997, we went from about 40,000 deportations in that year to 114,000 in 1997. So the second reason is you can change the law and you can render a lot of people deportable, but you also have to put money behind it. So the 1996 laws did involve some appropriations that led to the enhancement of immigration law enforcement. But the big kicker came with the creation of the Department of Homeland Security in 2002, which was a massive reorganization of the federal government. So what that did is just poured massive amounts of money into immigration law enforcement. It's kind of remarkable because the Department of Homeland Security's main mission is to keep the United States safe from terrorist attacks, but they spend at least half of their $60 billion budget on immigration law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Tell us the story. You have a new book out that looks at people who have been deported. You've written about Vern, and Vern, I'm sure, is somewhat typical. It's a very, very sad story. Vern, who had been in this country for 18 years and was deported. What's his story?
So Vern grew up in Guatemala, and when he was about 18 years old, he decided to try and come to the United States. And his reasons for coming to the United States were multifaceted. They were related to the violence in Guatemala at that time was going through. This was in around 1996. And so Guatemala was going through a civil war, which was in part sponsored by the United States, who we wanted the other side to win. The country has experienced a lot of turmoil. There's also a lot of economic development going on, but which was not creating jobs for people like Vern or weren't creating jobs that allow him to excel in the ways that he wanted to. So he decided to leave, and he traversed all of Mexico, and he got to the United States. And when he got there, he ended up settling in Ohio. And that was related to, during the 1990s, 1980s, there were a bunch of religious organizations that tried to help Guatemalan asylum seekers and refugees resettle. So he came to the United States, went to Ohio to help a religious organization, and he applied for asylum on the basis of the fact that he feared for his life in his country of origin. He put his application in, and when he did that, he was granted permission to work in the United States while he waited for his case. But the immigration courts were tremendously backlogged, so he actually waited 7 years for his case to be heard. And, you know, he's 20 years old, so he's right in the time when people tend to get married, have kids. So he did that. He married a woman named Maria who was also applying for asylum, and she was from Honduras. So they got married, and they had a kid. 7 years later, the letter comes saying his asylum plea had been denied. But by that time, he was already married. His wife was applying for legalization. They already had a kid. He had risen up in the factory he was working in. His wife had a job there. And they decided that they were just going to stay. And so he was hoping that maybe Maria's application would eventually be successful and then he might be able to get legalized. So he ended up having another child and continued working for many years. During this whole time, he's extremely careful not to break any laws because he's worried if he's apprehended by law enforcement, that might get him into the deportation dragnet. And kind of remarkably, so that story is pretty typical. What is actually unusual about his case is that ICE agents raided his home. I mean, especially someone with absolutely no criminal background. What he had is a deportation order from 1990, I can't remember exactly what year, but it was 7 years old. So because of that deportation order, the local ICE office perhaps had nothing better to do that day. So they sent several agents to his home very early in the morning, knocked on the door, you know, woke up his family, and very tragically tore him away from his wife and kids. You know, in front of the kids watched it, very traumatized by the event, and sent him packing to a detention center. He appealed his case, but eventually he was unsuccessful in appealing his case. He didn't have access to a lawyer. He wasn't able to afford to pay for an immigration lawyer, and he ended up being deported back to Guatemala, where he has found a job, but neither he nor his wife make enough money for them to be able to try, you know, for her to travel to Guatemala to visit him or take the kids to visit him. So now he just has to deal with talking to them on Skype every evening.
So he's completely separated at this point from his family in terms of being able to see each other and live together.
Exactly. I mean, his wife's case is still pending, so it's probably not a good idea for her to leave the United States.
Right.
Kids are too young, but even if all that were in order, they just don't have the money, you know, to make these international trips.
What about these appeals? Is there a due process of law involved? Why didn't he get a fair hearing?
Well, the immigration law system is completely separate from the criminal law system. So if you're facing deportation, in U.S. law, that's not considered a punishment. So you don't have all the due process protections that apply if you were facing jail time. So let's say you're facing deportation. You do get a hearing by someone who is called an immigration judge, but they're not actually in the judicial branch. They're an employee of the Department of Justice, right? So they're also an employee of the federal government. So they're in the executive branch. So you get a hearing with that person. But they don't necessarily have to, you know, they don't have to provide you with a lawyer in order to win your case. It's highly dependent on the discretion of the judge. But, you know, there's very interesting data that shows that some judges grant appeals in 95% of cases, and some judges grant appeals in 5% of cases. So, I mean, the luck of the draw in terms of the judge you get. The luck of the draw in terms of whether or not you're able to get legal representation. And appealing an asylum claim without legal representation, people are extremely unlikely to win. But the interesting thing is if you do have a lawyer, you're often able to win your case for asylum because people really are fleeing from life-threatening conditions in their country of origin.
So it was not taken into account the fact that he was an honest and hard worker for 18 years.
Right. Once he had the deportation order, there wasn't really any way for it to get overturned based on the current, you know, the legal structure.
You talk about this, and we're seeing inequality in so many ways in this country. It's found its way into the presidential election. You've written about citizens of wealthy countries, highly skilled professionals, who have the option of immigrating if they so choose, but it's not the case for the vast majority of people in the world who are poor.
Exactly. So, and I call that a kind of a new global apartheid, right? So the idea is that you know, I, for example, you know, I'm a middle-class white woman, and I work for a university, and I'm a citizen of the United States. So if I want to go, most countries in the world, I think there's a few countries that I might not be able to get a visa to, but I basically can travel visa-free to the vast majority of countries in the world. But even someone who are middle-class, Peruvian, for example, who doesn't have access to the same, to travel to the same country without a visa, and worse, you know, if someone in, I think the lowest country is Niger, right? So they only have access to travel to 22 countries of the world. So basically, depending on where you're born, you will have access to travel to other countries or not.
You also write, and we hear so many incredibly tragic stories of the perilous journey that so many migrants take, dying in boats trying to cross seas, the horrible way that many people from Central America have to get to the United States, and many of them just don't even make it.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's only gotten worse in terms of trying to get to the United States. So, In the 1970s and 1980s, when a lot of Mexicans were coming to the United States and the U.S. Economy dearly needed them to work in the service sector, it was sort of, we had two signs at the border. One said, help wanted, and one said, do not come. But they were sort of both there, you know, kind of figuratively. And it was, not to say that it was not difficult, but there were not very many deaths at the border. People were able to come through. There wasn't a lot of enforcement. There wasn't very much enforcement along the border, and people were able to come through. And during that time period, people came, worked for a couple of years, and then they went back. And then beginning in the 1980s, but particularly in the 1990s, we began to really toughen the border enforcement along the U.S.-Mexico border. And then what that did is really had two effects. On the one hand, it created a situation where people that made it across stayed, right, because they didn't want to go through that again. And on the other hand, it also increased the number of deaths along the border. So today, an average of one person a day dies trying to get across the U.S.-Mexico border. So that's for the Mexicans. But for the Central Americans, all of Mexico becomes a border, right? They have to get across the border between Guatemala and Mexico, and they have to get across all of Mexico where they're subjected to the interesting thing about it is they're subjected to a lot of violence, and the Mexican government has turned a blind eye to a lot of it. I was just at this presentation in Mexico City where the presenter pointed out that there are just thousands of kidnappings every year in Mexico, but there has not been a single arrest of a kidnapping ring, right? So it's, the people are basically acting with impunity in Mexico in terms of their treatment of migrants. So Guatemalans and Salvadorans and Hondurans that are trying to come to the United States, some of their greatest obstacle is just getting through Mexico and trying not to be mugged or killed or kidnapped or sexually assaulted or physically assaulted along the way.
Mm-hmm. And getting back to deportations, when you look at who is being deported from this country, I would imagine there are people who are not poor, who are living illegally in the United States, who are not minorities. The number of deportations falls most heavily, doesn't it, on Mexican immigrants and on Central American immigrants?
It does. You know, it's interesting. 98% of people who are deported from the United States are sent to Latin America and the Caribbean, even though 60% of non-citizens are from that region. So if you're not Mexican or Central American or Caribbean or South American, you have a much smaller chance of being deported. It's not to say they never are. You know, in 1 year, for example, you know, 500 Filipinos were deported, 300 Chinese, and then 26,000 Hondurans. So, and the numbers of undocumented in those populations are somewhat similar. So the question is, you know, why does that happen? Why is it the case that Latin Americans are targeted? And also, why are men targeted? Because 90% of deportees are men, even though about half of all non-citizens are women. And what I found through talking to people who had been deported and then listening to their stories and figuring out how they got deported, the major reason is sort of is how immigration law is enforced. And basically, if you, Immigration and Customs Enforcement only has about 5,000 agents. So those agents that went to Vern's door, I mean, there are five or six agents of 5,000 in the country. They can't actually arrest that many people just through using their own agency. Mm-hmm. They have to rely on local police.
Oh.
And local police are much more likely. There's been tons of studies that show that police departments tend to engage in racial profiling. So they're much more likely to pull over Latino men than they are to pull over Asian women, or they're more likely to pull over younger people than they are to pull over senior citizens, right? So there's all kinds of profiling that goes on with the police officers. So an elderly Ukrainian woman who's undocumented has an infinitesimal chance of being deported. By contrast, a Jamaican legal permanent resident who's a male who lives in New York City has about a 1 in 8 chance of being deported.
Mm. We're talking about immigration this hour of the program, and we're going to move to other areas of discussion. Just last week, the Supreme Court said that it would consider a legal challenge to the president's overhaul of the nation's immigration rules and executive authority here. They're going to rule on his plan to protect millions of illegal immigrants from deportation and allow them to work indefinitely in the country legally. Of course, there are people in a number of states who think that's a bad idea and it's an overstretch of his authority. We'll talk about what's behind the Supreme Court deciding to take that action. Also, this really interesting study from Pew that came out in November that shows that there are many more Mexicans who have left America than are entering the country now, too. So are we really seeing a time when even more people are escaping Mexico in particular and Central America? That number seems to be going down, according to statistics. We welcome your phone calls for our guest, who is Tanya Golash-Boza. She's an associate professor of sociology at the University of California at Merced. She's the author of a number of books, Deported, the most recent, Immigrant Policing, Disposable Labor, and Global Capitalism. We welcome your participation in the show, so please join us. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The topic this hour is immigration. We have many areas of that to explore, and the question we ask of you, the audience, is do you think that we have a really messed up immigration system in this country? Is it discriminating against those who are poor, whereas people who have a lot of money can travel pretty freely all over the country? Or do you think that we need to be protecting American citizens and those who are not here legally need to be sent back and as soon as possible? What do you make of, which is what we're going to talk about now with our guest, the Supreme Court taking up this program that the president created about almost a year, a little over a year ago, more than a year ago, actually 14 months ago, the program, the Deferred Action for Parents of Americans and Lawful Permanent Residents, and it would allow as many as 5 million illegal immigrants who are parents of citizens or lawful permanent residents to apply for a program that would keep them from being deported and provide them work permits. It's before the Supreme Court. Now we're going to talk about that. Welcoming phone calls for our guest, 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Professor Golash-Boza, what do you make of the Supreme Court hearing this case on the executive action by the president?
Yeah, it's interesting. You wonder the extent to which the people who are opposing DACA or DAPA, as they're called by their acronyms, it seems to be mostly political. I mean, if you think about it, it's a deferred action for childhood arrivals, a deferred action for parent arrivals. It's basically a prosecutorial discretion program, an extension of that. So any law enforcement agency has to exercise discretion. So the United States has 11 million undocumented immigrants, perhaps a little less. It has, as you mentioned earlier, the number has gone down. It might be closer to 10.5 million undocumented immigrants. At current rates, it would take about 20 or 30 years to deport all of them. So it's just not a feasible policy suggestion to say, let's just deport all of them. And anyone who says that is really just invoking rhetoric. Anyone kind of looks at what the law enforcement agency is capable of, what would be politically viable, knows that we're not going to deport all the people here. So we might as well decide among the people here who are illegally present, which ones should we focus on? And that's just, any law enforcement agency. Same thing with, for example, illegal drug use. It would be unrealistic for the Wisconsin Department of Public Safety to say, we're going to put behind bars every single person who engages in illegal substance use, because then you would have 10 to 15% of the population behind bars, which wouldn't be good for the state or good for anybody. So basically, it's just a way of systematizing prosecutorial discretion, giving deferment from deportation to people who have U.S. citizen children in the United States. It's a logical way if you're going to focus immigration law enforcement, which, I mean, you have to. So either way, the federal government is going to focus their immigration law enforcement, and either they can do it by, you know, through a program like this where it kind of normalizes it and puts it into law, or they can just do it anyway because this is not a valid policy proposal to say we're going to deport all 11 million undocumented migrants. For so many reasons. One is just we don't have the capacity, the law enforcement capacity to do so. We don't have the jails to put them in. We're not going to build them this year. The kind of human rights crisis that it would cause, the due process crisis. I mean, so it's just the international attention we would get for such a massive deportation, the sort of all kinds of historical traumas that would, you know, hearken to. Mm-hmm. So when I think about people, you know, we ask why would, you know, the state of Texas, for example, fight back against it? And it must be political, you know, some politician trying to gain points by saying, I'm fighting against the immigrants.
Right.
But really, I mean, it's just unrealistic.
Do you have any sense at all, Tanya, of where the Supreme Court is leaning on this?
I don't. Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have a crystal ball. And I'm not an expert on the Supreme Court. I think, there's so many constitutional lawyers that argue that it's completely within his realm. And if you think about the fact that President Obama is also a constitutional scholar, he's probably in compliance with the Constitution. So I think that would be, it's not unreasonable to expect that they would uphold DACA and DAPA.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to some phone calls. Our lines are filled. 800-486-8655 is our number. And Claire in Madison, our first caller. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Kathleen. Can I quick say you have the coolest producers. Scotty and Casey are so wonderful.
They are. You're right. Here's to them. Yeah.
Kathleen, this is so interesting to me because, you know, of course, the whole immigration issue is a huge Republican talking point. But this is my theory. The dirty secret is, and of course they have no offered solutions, the dirty secret is, they don't really want to get rid of all these migrant workers because it's cheap labor. These are the people that are the grunt workers in this country. They're farm laborers. They're kitchen dishwashers at restaurants. They're maids at hotels. These people work very, very hard. I used to be in that industry. I know how hard those folks work. And they don't really want them to go away. They might say they do, but they need them. And they can pay them very poorly to do the work that needs to get done.
Professor Golash-Boza.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point, and a lot of people would agree with you. And I would say if you were on the side of the workers themselves, the point would be to work to get them more rights, right? So I think the pushback should be basically, you know, they're here, we need them, how about we give them some rights? And I think DAPA does try and do that by giving them formal work authorization, because once you have actually authorization to work and you're not working under the table, you're in a position where you can fight for your rights and demand your rights, and that's better. So it's better for all workers of the United States if undocumented workers are able to work legally, because then they can demand their rights for themselves and then obviously also for their coworkers. So some of the proposals on the table would bring the undocumented workers out of the shadows and into a place where it's easier for them to fight for their rights, which would be better for all laborers.
Well, obviously, one of the main arguments on the other side is that these people who are coming to this country are taking jobs away from Americans. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good proposition. You know, I tell them this, the way I respond to that is this, there's this great story. So in the, many of you know, so Chicago had the meatpacking factories in the 1960s and 70s, and mostly black and white native-born workers worked in those meatpacking factories. So I don't buy the argument that black and white people won't work in meatpacking factories. So what happened in Chicago is, the black and white workers stood up for their rights, demanded unionization, demanded better working conditions, and the meatpackers were like, we're going to Iowa. They went to Iowa, where the unemployment rate in 1983 was 2%, right? So they're going to a place where there is nobody that wants to work there because, it's a basically full employment workforce. And then they recruited workers to come from Mexico, mostly from Mexico initially and later from Central America, to work in those meatpacking plants for much lower wages than the workers were getting in Chicago. And then they completely mechanized the process so that now the meat production actually went up about 10 to 20 times in terms of the way they were able to mechanize it. So the but the point is the Mexican, I mean, in a sense, you could blame the Mexicans for taking those jobs, but I think if you looked at the big picture, you would blame the employers for trying to, for basically trying to create a disposable workforce. And the other thing about the workers in Mexico is the average turnover at those meatpacking plants in Iowa is 1 year. So even if they only employ locals, you know, a year later they'd run out of workers. So what the meatpacking industry has done is sort of create intentionally a disposable workforce in with the effort to get profits. And a disposable workforce requires an immigrant labor force. Usually, you know, you need people that coming in and out. And, you know, we could argue that that should be changed, but now you're talking about a massive restructuring in how we produce food in the United States. So the issue just, you know, if you start out with the argument, you know, they're taking American jobs, it's just like the tip of the iceberg. And we have to really think about, you know, how is food produced in the United States? And we could talk about meatpacking, but we could talk about so many other industries. We could talk about farm work. You know, Mexicans and Central Americans have been doing farm labor in California for the last 80 years. You know, are we going to completely change that? I don't think so.
Thanks, Claire, for the call. Diana in Sturtevant. Hi, Diana.
Hi. I have a couple questions. What is the process that undocumented immigrants have to go through in order to become an American citizen? And aren't there programs out there to assist them in completing this so that they can be legitimate American citizens and pay taxes and be able to fight for their rights without having to go through the Supreme Court?
Thank you. That's a great question. Okay, so if you're an undocumented immigrant who lives in the United States and you crossed the border without permission from Mexico 20 years ago and you want to become a U.S. citizen, you probably don't have any way to do that. If you marry a U.S. citizen, you still may be ineligible for legalization. If you have U.S. citizen kids, you still may be ineligible. So basically the answer is, for the vast majority of undocumented immigrants in the United States, even if they have citizen children, even if they're married to citizens, even if they've been here for 20 years, they have absolutely no legal way to legalize. There's some immigrants who are undocumented who are able to legalize, and usually that's through asylum claims. So if you can prove that you would be persecuted on the basis of your social position in your country of origin, then you may win an asylum case, but rates of asylum granting for Mexico, for example, is like 2%. So it's extremely difficult to get, even though many people really do fear for their lives in Mexico. So basically the answer is for the vast majority of undocumented immigrants, there's no path to legalization. And that's actually what they've been asking for. So the United States Congress has not passed a legalization program since 1986.
Oh, my goodness.
So we've been 30 years
long time
without any new avenues for people to legalize.
Didn't marriage used to be a route to citizenship? If you married a U.S. citizen, don't you have dual citizenship? I guess not, huh?
Well, I mean, so it depends. If you're, but there's so many caveats to it that it can be very difficult. So, for example, I met a woman who was a U.S. citizen, and her husband was undocumented. So she thought, you know, we'll get married, and then he can get his papers. But it turned out that he had come to the United States as a child, and then when he was about 20, he went back home to Mexico to visit to his grandfather's funeral, and then he came back to the United States. So the fact that he went back to Mexico once and re-entered, he had now committed an immigration crime and is permanently ineligible for legalization. So it's never under current laws, even though he's been to the United States since he was a child, even though he only went to Mexico once, he went there for a funeral. Basically, the avenue is completely blocked. So there's just so many provisions that make it difficult or impossible for the vast majority of undocumented immigrants to legalize.
That's quite a story. I believe most people don't know that, that you can't even go to a funeral in your country where you were born. Diana, thanks very much for the call. This email from Jane: we can start to enforce the current immigration laws when it comes to those employing illegals. If the jobs dry up, some of these people will go home on their own. President Obama took an oath to faithfully execute the laws of the land, so why is he not enforcing our immigration laws?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And unfortunately, I mean, if you think about it, if we do have laws in the books that say that we should prosecute employers who willfully employ undocumented immigrants. One caveat, though, they have to willfully do it. So the law actually says that they have to know. So if they say they don't know, then they often can get away with it and nothing happens to them. But if we were to remove all undocumented immigrants of the United States tomorrow, which, as I explained earlier, is not possible, but they make, undocumented immigrants make up a quarter of the labor force in roofing, in kitchens, in farming. So, I mean, there's just vast sectors of the labor force that would just go under and that basically affect our ability to survive in this country. So it's just not a viable solution, whether you think about deporting all of the undocumented workers or just firing them. And, you know, so even if President Obama were to sort of focus more specifically on employers, which presidents have done occasionally, it's just, it's such a massive problem that it can't be solved through immigration law enforcement.
What do you see as the genesis of the anger toward immigrants, the people, and there are many of them in this country? Donald Trump has made it one of his central campaign points to build this, fence and to deport 11 million people. Why do people respond to that, do you think?
Well, I think it has to do with dehumanization, and it has been part of our legacy as a country since the very beginning. So the very first immigration law that we passed was the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act. And then in 1924, we passed the quota laws that basically made it impossible for anybody who wasn't from Western Europe to come to the United States. So immigration policy in the United States has always been infused with nativism and then with racialized fears. So the discourses surrounding the Chinese, the Eastern Europeans, and then the Mexicans and now the Central Americans have always been sort of couched in this, you know, fear of the other taking over the United States, and they've always been couched in race. So I think it's for politicians in particular, it's an easy mechanism to say, you know, let's not, you know, oh, yeah, the financial crisis happened. You know, let's not blame the banks. Let's blame the undocumented workers. You know, they're horrible. They're taking our jobs. And sort of it's like what they call a weapon of mass distraction. And people buy into it in part because we were used to hearing these kind of racist and nativist tropes that people find it kind of easy to buy into. And I think that has to do with our long history of racialized discourses and racial inequality.
We're talking about many aspects of immigration this hour of the program. Our guest is the author most recently of Deported, Immigrant Policing, Disposable Labor, and Global Capitalism. Tanya Maria Golash-Boza is with us, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Merced. With immigration, deportation, so much in the news these days, and with the Supreme Court about to consider, I guess the hearings will be in April, is that right? And then their decision on May on whether or not President Obama's actions are legal. They have been challenged by quite a few states. We're looking at what drives people here and whether or not there's a huge disparity, which our guest has documented, between those who have and those who have not when it comes to be able to travel the world and work in many parts of the world, that those who have more are able to do that much, much more easily. All right, more phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Immigration is what we talk about this hour. Joe in Marinette, hello.
Hi, great show. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First, let me say that about 15 years ago, I was displaced by an H-1B visa person, a good academic position, and it was written such that a tiny sliver of the requirement made this person more eligible than I was. So I agree with all of the above that the laws are poorly written, and I squarely put the blame on Congress in action, and Obama has to take things in his own hand because Congress doesn't do anything. They have a long-term vision and cuts to actually
All right, your phone is really cutting out, but we get the gist of what you're saying. And let's center on Congress for a moment. This is a long time without an overhaul of our immigration policy. They have not wanted to take this up for so many years. For what reason, Tanya?
They're probably stuck between a rock and a hard place. So the voters, you know, wanting Congress to stand up for the rights of U.S. citizens, just like the caller was saying, you know, the H-1B visa program, which can disadvantage workers, you know, U.S. citizens. And then the undocumented immigrants themselves are not really a constituency, right? So by virtue of their inability to vote. Now, they are increasingly having family members, you know, as their children. So since 1986, since there hasn't been a legalization program, what that means is we have lots of children who've grown up with their parents who are undocumented citizens. So we're seeing the rise of a constituency, and that's why people think that maybe one day we will get some action. And then the industry leaders who do rely on undocumented workers and don't really want to change. And I'll tell you a very quick story about that.
Sure.
So in 1986, we passed the Immigration Reform and Control Act, which legalized about 400,000 undocumented workers. And there was a special provision in there where farm workers who had been in the United States for 6 months could get legalized. So farm workers were able to get their papers. But then there was a company in Florida, and they had sugarcane workers, most of whom were undocumented. And they really wanted to keep those workers undocumented so much that the lobbyists from the sugar corporation came to Congress and argued that sugarcane is a grass, and therefore they're not agricultural workers. And so basically, they were not interested in their workers becoming legalized. They did not want their workers to be able to stand up for their rights. You know, sugarcane picking is one of the most onerous agricultural work there is out there. So basically, that kind of shows how corporations don't just want the workers, they want them undocumented. So basically, they won. I mean, remarkably, Congress went ahead and gave an exception, said, okay, well, sugarcane's a grass, and then the law says only people who pick fruits or vegetables are agricultural workers. So the sugarcane workers are ineligible for legalizing. Mm.
It's really a sign of their shirking a major responsibility. Yeah. Who comes into the country, how people are deported, whether or not they should be, who has access to open borders. It's kind of a basic responsibility of legislators, don't you think?
I definitely agree that there's definitely responsibility, because creating this sort of second, what, by not passing any laws that legalize people, basically what you're doing is creating this huge second-class citizen population, and we have a long history of that, you know, with slavery, and that's not something that a lot of people think we should continue to have.
800-486-8655 is our number, and we have a line open if you'd like to join us. Don in Coon Valley, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Say, listen, the question that I have is, I hear people complaining about, you know, Obama's executive order, and I don't quite understand what the authority of executive orders rest on and what kind of suit would be brought against it. I mean, like, is it in the Constitution or is it just precedent? I mentioned to your screener that I thought I'd heard somewhere that Eisenhower moved forward with the interstate highway system on an executive order, and that was a pretty big deal. So, I don't know. I don't quite understand all the ins and outs of the legitimacy or illegitimacy of executive order.
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, Tanya's not a Supreme Court expert. You must know something about this. Do you think that it is within the purview of executive action?
Yeah, and also I think what's notable, I think President Obama has actually passed fewer executive orders than other presidents. This one in particular has come to the attention. So, and if you think about, I think about this particular executive order this way: immigration law enforcement is completely in the purview of the executive branch. They're the ones in charge with enforcing the law. So basically, his executive order is saying, this is how we're going to enforce the law. We're not going to deport this group of people right now. Right? So I think that's completely in the purview. Now, the question of giving out work permits, well, that's the Department of Labor, right, which is also under the executive branch. So I think it's pretty easy to see that this could easily be interpreted as totally in the purview of the executive branch, especially since the legislative branch is definitely not doing their job.
Yeah. And according to a New York Times article I have in front of me, it says this: in their written arguments before the court, the states and those who are bringing their criticism of the executive action, the states acknowledge that the president does have wide authority over immigration matters, telling the justices that the executive does have enforcement discretion to forbear from removing aliens on an individual basis. Their quarrel was with what they call a blanket grant of lawful presence to millions of immigrants, entitling them to various benefits. That's just something in a nutshell, but we definitely will do a show on this as the hearings get closer before the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And thank you, Don, very much for your call. Jose in Milwaukee. Hi, Jose.
Hello. I just had a question for your guest regarding the if she knew anything about what happens to the income taxes that immigrants, undocumented, of course, pay, because they, most of them work through temporary agencies, and they take income tax from them. And who gets it, or where does it go?
Yeah, it's a good question. A lot of people think undocumented immigrants don't pay taxes. So, of course, they pay property taxes, they pay sales taxes, they pay all kinds of taxes. And then most undocumented immigrants actually also pay payroll taxes. But then they're ineligible to apply for a refund at the end of the year if they happen to pay too much. So as to where it goes, it just goes back into the system. And relatedly, they also pay Social Security, right, 6% of their income, which they never will have access to. So there's a... And thinking about the underfunding of Social Security, having undocumented immigrants pay Social Security, they're never going to get access to the money that they've paid into Social Security. And there was, during the President George W. Bush administration, there was a discussion about allowing undocumented immigrants to access that, sort of a mutual agreement with Mexico, because, you know, if they retire and go back to Mexico, Mexico doesn't want to have to pay for it either. But then 9/11 happened, and all those discussions were foreclosed. Mm.
Professor Golash, please give us an update. It wasn't all that long ago, although time goes pretty quickly. It may have been a year ago when the news was dominated by stories of young children who were crossing the border and who were in these detention camps, and some of them had family members who were in the United States. They were trying to get there. They were tragic stories of sometimes very young children. What's happening with children and with others now who are attempting to cross the border? Are they in detention centers? Are there more detention centers? What's going on, and why is the story not in the news anymore?
Yeah, so immigration detention increased from in 1994. We had a daily average of about 5,000 people in immigration detention. And then it went up to 34,000 in 2011. And it stayed there since. It's right about 34,000 this year. It's not in the news, and it's very remarkable sector of the law enforcement industry. So what happened is, one of the most interesting things is, in 2009, Senator Robert Byrd added a line to the DHS appropriations bill that says the Department of Homeland Security is required to maintain a level of not less than 34,000 detention beds. And that line was in the 2010 appropriations bill all the way, and it was in the 2015 appropriations bill. So actually, the Congress has mandated to DHS, Department of Homeland Security, that they have to have 34,000 beds for immigrants. So when you're an immigrant in detention, that just means you're waiting for your trial, or you're waiting to be deported if you've already been ordered deported. And just like I was explaining with immigration court, you don't have the same due process protections as someone that's in prison. So you don't have the right to a hearing. You don't have the right to bail. You know, and the other factor here is that 62% of people in immigration detention facilities are in for-profit facilities.
For-profit?
62%.
I didn't know that. Oh. Thanks, Jose, very much for your call. Let's go to Deborah in Milwaukee. Hello, Deborah.
Hi.
Hi.
What a great show. I always thought we should just set up shop for immigrants from Mexico out west, and then we can cut down on imports to and from China. But I think it's already there. I think that leads to my question. What would happen to our economy if all the vineyard workers from Mexico and, half of California is, or three-quarters of California is probably employed by immigrants. So I'm just curious.
Yeah, what would happen? I mean, so what would happen is certain sectors of the economy would just go under, right? So food production, food manufacturing, food processing, and then construction. So undocumented immigrants don't work in every industry, right? They're not on Wall Street. They're not working at the university where I work, right? They're not working for the federal government. They're working in sort of mostly in service sector industries, and then mostly in food production and in certain sectors of the manufacturing industry. So when you have a sector that 24% of the workers are undocumented, and you take away 24% of workers, I mean, you can't replace a workforce from one night to the next. So it would be an economic disaster.
Mm. We go next to Carl in Lone Rock. Hi, Carl.
Hello.
Yes, Carl. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling in to kind of call attention to something that happens with immigration. You were talking about marriage as a way to get citizenship here, and there's a kind of a loophole in our immigration system where if a foreign national marries a U.S. citizen, they can almost immediately claim some sort of abuse, and if they apply for their green card through the Violence Against Women Act, where it intersects the immigration system, then they get immediate, if their application is accepted, they get immediate free legal help and all kinds of stuff. But the U.S. citizen spouse then also gets silenced. They cannot present any evidence contrary to what the foreign national is presenting to the immigration people.
All right. I'm not very familiar with this. Are you familiar?
Yeah,
with this?
I'm familiar with the okay. Violence Against Women Act. Yes, it's a good question. So under the Violence Against Women's Act, if you're an undocumented immigrant, and usually it's women, but also could be a man, and your husband says to you, you know, if you do this or if you don't do this, I'm going to, if you call the police on me beating you, we're not going to process your paperwork. So there's been a longstanding problem of U.S. citizens married to undocumented immigrants who would hold their status over their heads, basically abuse them verbally, physically, sexually. So the Violence Against Women Act was enacted to try and prevent that, so that a partner, you know, couldn't hold that over your head, couldn't hang that over your head. I've known people who've been able to legalize through that act. And I've also, you know, interestingly, I was in France a few years ago, and I met a few women who were from Cuba. And in France, they don't have this kind of law, right, where you can legalize if you're there is an avenue for legalization if you can prove that your spouse was abusive to you, and particularly if they were using your status, kind of holding it over your head. You are able to legalize through that. So it is one avenue for legalization for people who are victims of domestic abuse. So anyway, I was in France where they don't have that provision. Actually, in France, if you marry a French citizen, you have to stay married to that French person for 5 years, or else you cannot. And they come check on you every year, make sure you're still married.
Really?
Yes, otherwise you can't get legalization. So I met a few women who were from Cuba, and they had left Cuba, and it's very difficult to leave Cuba, and it's very, very difficult to go back if you've left, especially during this time period a few years ago. And their husbands were abusive to them, but they couldn't leave, right? I mean, they were stuck between, you know, in a very difficult situation. If they didn't stay with their husband, they weren't going to get legalization in France, and they couldn't go back to Cuba after having left, you know, basically seen as traitors to the state.
Yes.
So that's why we have VAWA, right? So that kind of situation doesn't happen, so that a woman doesn't have to stay in an abusive relationship because their partner is holding their status over their head.
Hmm. About a minute left. Dick and Kiwani. Hi. Dick, are you there?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Okay, well, I know some people who immigrated to the United States legally. One of them was from the Philippines. The other one was from Eastern Europe. And they're not real happy with the immigrant situation in this country. They spent thousands of dollars and hours of their lives in court trying to get legalized. And there's people that come across every day illegally, keyword being illegally, and they just get to stay here. And so I was just wondering what the guest's point of view was for the people who try to immigrate legally.
All right, Tanya.
Yeah, so the United States has a cap on coming from the Philippines, coming from all the countries. So, yeah, it's true. If you are in the Philippines and your brother's a U.S. citizen, you can apply for legalization and, you know, it costs a few thousand dollars and you wait in line and 18 years later you'll get your green card. Same thing for Mexico. The line is also about 18 years. So a lot of people do that. They do the process. They wait the time period. They wait it out. And other people, you know, they want to be with their families, so they come before, you know, so there's a lot of people that are actually eligible for legalization, but the wait period is 10 years, 15
Goodness.
Years, 20 years.
Wow.
So they just say, you know, I'm going to try and go illegally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, unfortunately, they also spend a lot of money. You know, to come illegally from China costs about $30,000. To come illegally from Brazil, about $15,000. Mm-hmm. But they're putting that, instead of giving that money to the U.S. government, they're giving that money to human smugglers who often abuse them.
Tanya, thank you very much for the highly interesting and troubling hour, actually. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the time to talk.
Tanya Golash-Boza, our guest, and her book is Deported, Immigrant Policing, Disposable Labor, and Global Capitalism. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this program, and thanks to Scotty and Kendra Smith, our new intern for on-air production.